and welcome to this very special edition of the Beyond podcast. We are rushing this through into production because there is a production of The Tragedy of Meriem coming up very, very soon. If you're listening to this about the time it comes out, it's in the future. If you're listening to this in the future, then it might be in the past. But hopefully you can go out and buy tickets or even contribute to making the show come about and come into a reality. We obviously on this podcast love Meriem very, very much. We've done quite a lot of stuff on Meriem so far. And one day the full cast audio adaptation will come about. It will happen. I will finish it, editing it. It will be real one day. But till then, we have this wonderful production that's coming to Stoke Newington. And we're looking forward very much to hearing about that from our wonderful guest today. So, wonderful guest, who are you and what is your purpose in life?
So my name is Jasmine Silk. I founded Cut Purse Theatre with the express aim of creating Meriem because I found out about the play and generally, as usual, get very angry about women's plays not being very well known and went, okay, we're going to do a play. And so purpose in life, probably directing feminist plays.
It's a great play to choose. I could talk about Meriem all day. I will let you to talk about Meriem first. But before that, tell us a little bit about Cut Purse. You've sort of given us an outline. What are you? Where is that based? What's going on with that?
So Cut Purse was founded a few months ago to do this play originally. So I've been directing for a few years, doing a lot of kind of verse-based work and did a lot of research in the area. And as part of that, found out about Meriem and lots of well-known plays by women writers who I just had no idea existed so far back in history. I think there's this assumption that they don't until even like the 1800s, 1900s. So got very excited and went, okay, want to do this play, start the company. So that's where Cut Purse came about. And a big part of the idea behind Cut Purse is bringing these plays into kind of the modern day to a relevant audience through cross-industry collaboration. So working with musicians, working with live music, to work with people who work in other live art forms, other art forms, to bring theatre to new audiences. Often theatre can feel like a bit of a bubble and we're all very excited about each other's shows, but getting other people as excited can be difficult. And creating something that feels accessible to a different audience. And so we were thinking a lot about the fact that gigs are something that much more people feel excited by. And you go to a gig and you have fun and you're really engaged and the music can tell a story in a really interesting way. So we, from the start, wanted to have a live band involved in some capacity. And so we have a live band for the Wednesday and Thursday shows called Fight Milk, who are this really wonderful female-led rock band and are just absolutely brilliant, and everyone should go listen to them. Beyond that as well, we're looking to speak to a lot of kind of other bands and musicians in the lead up about being women in the creative industries and about the different challenges that creates and what it does to find out that work like this exists so historically. Because I think sometimes knowing that women have always been creating and being a part of these industries just makes a difference to how you perceive your own work and your place in it. And yeah, so we're talking to lots of really cool female run businesses as well, and yeah, kind of trying to do the cross industry thing.
Because I mean, that's the thing about Meriem is it comes with this sort of series of qualifiers about how to describe it, because it's the first play written in English by a woman that is an original tragedy. And we've got earlier translations, and we've got other earlier works that might have been, you might be able to argue, might be female-led. And we've got, nuns writing in Latin and things like that, going even further back. But this one is the first original that we have by a woman writing in the early 17th century. You obviously love the play. Tell the audience a little bit about The Tragedy of Meriem if they haven't already listened or watched to the sort of 14 hours worth of content that we've produced on the If you're new to this, tell the newbies.
Okay, so The Tragedy of Meriem, apart from being very cool for being the first, as you say, original play written by a woman in English with qualifier and qualifier, it is a very cool story as well. It has two female protagonists called Meriem and Salome, and takes place over the course of one day. And at the start of the day, everyone in the court comes to believe that King Herod, Meriem's husband, is dead. And as a result of this, all chaos ensues. Everyone suddenly can do all of the things that they couldn't do when Herod was around, and very quickly get to doing those things. And all the while, Mariam is having this moment of thinking, I am sad about my husband's death, but also happy about it because he was a terrible person. Hence, everyone celebrating that he's dead. And so everyone gets on with breaking all of Herod's rules. And of course, about halfway through the play, Herod reappears alive, well, and actually more successful than before. And Mariam finds her crisis is suddenly somewhat resolved because she realizes immediately, no, she did not want him to be alive, and refuses to pretend that she's happy he's back. And as a result, things all start to go a little wrong. And of course, all of the things everyone did when Herod was away get discovered. And we have everyone kind of dealing with the comeuppance of the first half of the play. And all the while, of course, you have Salome, Herod's sister, who is using this chaos to get everything she wants and understands that she can break the rules around her to get what she wants in a way that Mariam doesn't necessarily get.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Salome is great because she wins. I mean, almost, you know, she gets almost everything she wants. Okay, her boyfriend, some things happen to him.
Kind of fine.
It's a flesh wound. It's fine. Yeah. But apart from that, we sort of think of the play as, you know, is it the tragedy of Mariam or is it the triumph of Salome? Because it's just, if anybody wins, I mean, I think the historical Salome actually becomes effective ruler after Herod dies.
Yeah, she does.
So
she lives to be like 75.
Yeah.
She lives so long.
And the you know, she gets some wonderful speeches where she's got a fist in the air, you know, absolutely great stuff. And then she is also a horrible person in other ways as well. But there's such good motivation for why she does the relatively terrible things that she does. And it's so, so much fun.
I mean, none of these people are good people. Mm. And I think that's part of what I like about the play, is that it manages to have these women who are really complex and really exciting to watch and have these incredible speeches and are just better than even female characters we tend to get today. They're absolutely brilliant to watch, but they are also, they're not like your unproblematic heroes. They're not these women you idolize because they're these perfect symbols of women taking their power and everything. They are really complicated, often horrible, problematic people. And I think that makes them better as characters. Like Mariam is also, while she still does become sort of a hero in this play and how she's portrayed, she's also a terrible person at points. Like she is so awful when she's like arguing with Salome and very arrogant in herself. And so you have these characters who feel quite real and they have their own challenges.
Yeah, especially Mariam, who sort of internalized her mother's racism because her mother is, you know, just turns up and is just appallingly racist at the beginning of the play. And you're just sort of going, you almost think it's Mariam just sitting there going, oh, Mum, no, shush. But actually, Mariam has internalized some of that as well in her own dealings with Salome, even if it's not that sort of extreme level. And it's that final act as well when we hear about what happens at the end of the play. I don't think it's a tragedy, but so let's say it doesn't go well. But there are certain things related at the end of the play where you're sort of going, there's some really strange dynamics going on between family members. And this is all a family jostling for power in really interesting ways. So in your production, technically it has quite a large cast list, but actually a lot of it doubles down in various ways. In terms of adapting it and how you're casting it, how you're playing with it, what sort of changes or play-arounds have you done with the text?
So there was a lot of dealing with the fact that this play was obviously inspired by kind of a Greek form. And so the 24, all happening in 24 hours, it has a chorus who are commenting on the events of the play quite a lot. And dealing with how you present that in a way that's going to appeal to people who don't necessarily engage with classical texts much, because we obviously want this to have a wide appeal because we want to bring the play to as many people as possible. So we did a lot of kind of turning the chorus into characters, melding them with other characters. So in our production, the two chorus members become Grafina and Soemus. And so they become a more consistent presence in the play and in the court. And similarly, much of the action often happens where you will have a character come on and say their monologue and say their piece, but a lot of the actual action will happen off stage, or you'll be told about what's happening to someone. So to make it clearer and to make this a more kind of consistent world, We've done a lot of putting characters in scenes, even if they're not speaking, they're in the background, they're seeing things, we're following what they're seeing and what they know in a kind of clearer way as well. And so, yeah, really playing with that. And that's a big part of as well what we did with the music. We knew we wanted these music moments in it because it gives you time to almost do a music video where you're like, and this is what the characters did in between those scenes. Because not everyone catches everything that's explained in verse, of course. So, yeah, did a lot of that. Turned the chorus into people. That was a big one. Grafina was my favourite thing that came out of that. And is a bit cheeky because we have technically changed what happens to her character because the chorus we also gave all the servant lines. But Grafina is the wife of Ferrerus, Herod's brother, and Herod didn't want them to get married. It's described as lower class than Ferrerus, and they get married while Herod is dead. And then when Herod comes back, Ferrerus will do anything to ensure that that marriage isn't destroyed by that, and ends up playing a part in getting Constabrus and Mariam, in a sense, as well, killed. And so we ended up giving the lines of the servant who helps get Mariam killed to Grafina and developing this kind of couple's narrative and trying to survive post-Hera's return much more. And to try and give someone a plot they can follow and give the death of the servant who helps, spoilers, giving certain deaths more significance, more emotional weight. I think she's an interesting thing that's come out of that, and that was mostly a casting and editing decision for clarity, but turned into more of a character.
Yeah, because we do have, you're right, you've got these characters who come on and who make a speech and then you never see them again. And that's quite frustrating. You're going, oh, there's a nugget of a really interesting character here. There's something really interesting going on there. But the play doesn't give us that chance to get in, dig into them. And, you know, that's really nice. I'm really looking forward to seeing this. I've produced Mariam many times. I've not seen it. So I'm quite looking forward to seeing other people doing things with it. So, yeah, Herod turns up at the end, and then suddenly it's Herod. There's a lot of Herod.
There's a lot of Herod. It's most of the second act is just Herod chatting. And you have to, yeah. We've been having a lot of conversations about that, actually, because it's just the poor actor.
It's, you know, sometimes you, as an actor, you're sitting there going, I want a good, big, chunky speech. I want a, you know, something to do. And then sometimes you go, no, okay, that's enough now. That's cool. I'll settle for less. That's fine. Because it's, there's some, I love the relationship between him and his sister and that dialogue they have there. And the mercurial nature is fascinating. Then you've got to navigate that final act when there's just so much words coming at an audience, describing things that have happened off, you know, quite complicated bits of exposition going on there. You've sort of moved some things around and played with how they're going to actually be presented.
Yes, we're doing a lot of things happening on stage that aren't necessarily scripted, just so some things are clearer. For example, a lot of the arrests we do have happen on stage rather than someone just being sent like, go arrest this person, because it can so easily get missed. Yes, we also did cut this play a lot because it is true across the board that these characters talk and then they keep talking and then they talk some more. And you have these like 3-page monologues where you go, okay, a lot of this is brilliant, but for someone to watch this and understand it, we're going to have to play with how we treat that. So there's a lot of like doing, there's a lot of things happening in the monologues and actually making a thing of the fact that Herod, for example, just doesn't have this sense of when no one's listening anymore. Like he's just unable to not say what he's thinking aloud and just kind of completely gets tangled in his own sort of web there. And yes, definitely playing with that. And we've been playing a lot with making them clear and involving the movement, breaking them up, which helps considerably. Actually, so like, honestly, when I first looked at the play, I was like, oh, can you do speeches this long to a modern audience? And as we started to go over it, what came out was we actually found so much of the comedy in them that I missed when I first read it. Like Mariam is so sarcastic on so many occasions. And so these speeches, when you start, she has like a 2-page speech at the beginning. But when you start to break that up, we kept describing her at one point as Fleabag because there is this energy of her just coming on and just expressing a crisis to someone. And having these deeply sarcastic lines where she's referencing both being a woman and her feelings about her husband in a way that is genuinely very funny and engaging. So that's helped a lot as well, the comedy of it.
Yes, and I think this is one of the problems with a modern person coming to a text like this and looking at it and just going, oh, there are just all these long speeches. It doesn't feel dynamic. When you break it down, you go, no, actually, there's a lot going on here. There's a lot that you can play with, and there is more comedy in it. A lot more comedy than on, the tragedy of Marion on the surface looks like it has, and there's so much potential that a production can push in one way or pull in another, and that's what we're always looking for, is, you know, what the options, how far can this text push you in different directions? I mean, luckily it isn't an excessively long text overall in terms of, you know, the early modern period. You know, this is mercifully short.
Yes.
It only feels, because of the length of those individual speeches, that's the big neoclassical thing, that's the genre of the play, that's what they do, and yeah, playing around with that and deciding what you want to do with it is so much fun. Tell us a little about the venue and how audiences can book tickets and see it and all those exciting things.
Yes, so we are at the truly incredible Old Church in Stoke Newington, which is literally called the Old Church. And it is an Elizabethan church, so much of the Elizabethan stuff still remains. And it's turned into a part church, part gig venue now. And so is independently run and is just absolutely gorgeous and amazing. And can just recommend anyone seeing it if they get the chance. And we are going to be there on the 27th, 28th, 30th of April and 1st of May, performing this show with matinees on the 30th of April and 1st of May, as well as evening shows. And you can book tickets via the Old Church's website, or if you go on to Cutpurse Theatre on Instagram or on Twitter, you can find the ticket links on the posters and in all of our link trees. And they are, how much are they? They are £12.50 for a ticket or £10 at concession. So if you're under 28 or qualify for any of the other concession reasons, you can get a cheaper ticket.
Yay. So, yes, so that is the year 2022 for anyone listening.
Very
in the future.
New.
Links are will all be in the show description. So if you need to find a link to the show, you should be able to find it by just looking at the podcast words that go with the podcast. Yes, and all those other things online. Sadly, we're going to have to close the session around about now because you've got to go and, you know, make the show and I've got to make this into a podcast. Is there any, are there any final words you'd like to say to the audience about this show or why they should see it?
I think the main thing is just that, I mean, Elizabeth Carey, the writer, is incredible, and realizing that women like this existed, that women have been making art for as long as women have been around, that women did not simply turn on their brains when suffrage came into existence, and they've been questioning these roles in society and seeing these incredibly modern and real and relatable female characters in a verse play. It's something so unusual and so worth getting to see, and even if you can't get down to see it, looking up and reading a bit of, because I think it changes our whole perception about women's value in the arts the fact that they do belong there, that we've always belonged there and been artists, even if we haven't necessarily been recognised in the canons in the same way that men's work has. It's just a really, really empowering thing to find out about and that everyone should just have a look at, because it changes our view of that time.
Yes, and if you'd like to explore further online on Beyond, we have a number of read-throughs as well as explorings and spoiler sessions on not only the tragedy of Marion but also the tragedy of Antony as well as the tragedy of Iphigenia, translated by various women playwrights from a similar period. Other explorations are on their way to work through the female canon as existing, but they're all works in progress at this time. All that remains is to thank my wonderful guest, Jasmine. Thank you very much for joining us, and goodbye.
Thank you for having me.